This week's episode of Infinite Canvas Ultra is sponsored by Midwest Action. Midwest Action is a record and tape label as well as a blog based here in our hometown of Chicago. Midwest Action showcases the best and brightest in the Midwestern music scene, covering genres of all types, from lo-fi garage rock to hip-hop, psychedelic rock, and more. For more information on their releases and events sponsored by Midwest Action, you can head to MidwestAXN.com or search MidwestAXN at Bandcamp. Midwest Action. Listen local. Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 22 of Infinite Canvas Ultra. I'm Daniel Fioria.
I'm Michael Lane.
And this week, we are going to be reviewing Sam Mendes' new World War I pick, 1917.
Mm-hmm. We will also be going over some of our predictions for the 2020 Oscars.
Lots to talk about there. Very interesting picks this year.
Yeah.
Both good and kind of bad.
Yeah, we'll kind of go over the nominations and give an overview and then probably talk about some of our own feelings. Maybe give some predictions on what we think's going to win, what we think should also have won or will win. But yeah, that should be fun.
Absolutely. We're also going to talk about two pretty high-profile comic book films that just had some trailers put out this week.
One maybe a little less high-profile, I think.
Yeah.
But we'll get into it in a moment here.
So, nothing but movies this week on Infinite Canvas Ultra. Stay tuned. Infinite Canvas Ultra, episode 22. So, two trailers that just came out this week. Mm-hmm. Two movies that we will probably review on the show and once they come out.
Yeah.
Actually, there's one I think we could avoid altogether, especially if it gets bad reviews.
Yeah.
If it doesn't, obviously we'll wind up going to see it. We're both suckers for, you know, good Rotten Tomatoes scores.
I find that
comic book movies. But I find that very doubtful that one of these films is going to garner that, but we'll see.
Yeah.
Movies in question, Morbius, the Sony Pictures by way of Marvel Studios Spider-Man movie.
Yeah.
Well, I guess now it's not so Spider-Man list.
Yeah, well, I doubt it will have Spider-Man in it, or unless like maybe a cameo, but yeah, at this point it seems like a spin-off of that universe. Although at least unlike Venom, it actually seems to take place in the Sony Spider-Man universe.
Right.
So,
which is, yeah, this is so hilarious to go from one picture where it seems like none of this happens in this universe to one that's like, oh yeah, here's the Vulture.
Yeah.
Here's a, you know,
Here's a mural of Spider-Man on the wall,
which is still from the PS4 game, which is very interesting.
Oh, is it?
Like, that image they use is the, when you wear the Raimi suit in the game and you have the load screen, that's one of the load screens.
Oh,
it's him, like, in that position.
That's weird.
Whoever at Sony put that in kind of should be fired. That's so lazy.
I kind of love it, though.
That's the laziest shit ever. It's hilarious.
Yeah, and the other film we're going to be talking about that just released probably the last trailer it will have before its February 7th release, I believe.
Which is insane. That's so soon.
Yeah.
I feel like this movie had no, like, publicity almost at all.
Yeah, but we're obviously talking about Birds of Prey, or the whatever the long title of
Emancipation
of Harley Quinn, I believe.
Or whatever.
Which I kind of like, you know, it's a little ridiculous of a title, but I kind of like that, you know, like, or like Doctor Strangelove or How I Learned to Love the Bomb kind of thing.
Exactly.
I
have a good feeling about that movie overall.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason with that film, just from both trailers that I've seen, for some reason that movie just looks to me like something that could become kind of a cult classic in the next couple years if it's done right.
Right.
If it's done like I'm hoping it's done. Which is really cool because I feel like there's really nothing like that happening in comic book films where it's this whole movie ensemble cast of women being badass, you know, taking on this, like, you know, how Black Mask appears to be in this movie is this, like, you know, kind of, you know, manipulative asshole. It's like, it's cool. It's really cool.
It kind of seems like what we would have wanted Suicide Squad to have been.
Right.
This looks, whereas I despise that Suicide Squad film that they made, and Harley Quinn was the lone gem, you know, in Diamond in the Rough.
Margot Robbie is perfect casting for that character. It's just absolutely
and
great.
I thought the character was well handled there. You know, you know, she was the legitimately the best part of that movie. The most fun you could have watching that movie, I think, is spending all your time with her. So I'm pretty excited for Birds of Prey. I think the trailers at least exude a sense of just entertainment. Like, it just looks fun to watch.
Yeah.
I feel like the cinematography, or more specifically the colors that they're using in these trailers, it just looks like it'll be a nice film to look at.
Yeah.
Just in terms of its coloring and just how bright and vibrant it is. But yeah, I also assume it will be probably pretty violent and go places, like, you know, because it is a rated R film, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is the first time DC's done that. Oh, well, I guess Joker, right?
Which that kind of
I guess that's probably what bumped this one to that R-rated status, I'm sure.
Right. I feel like that was almost kind of, they were kind of like waiting to see how Joker did before he, because I feel like the rating for this film has come very late.
Yeah.
Like, the first trailer had no rating at all, so I feel like they were kind of trying to see if that could be a success.
And then Joker made $1 billion, so they're like,
and
yeah.
To be honest, I mean, with the stature of a character like Harley Quinn, I could very well see this, I don't know about $1 billion, but it'll do very well.
Yeah, I mean, if it's supposed to be as good as, or, you know, if it comes out and it's really well regarded, I'm sure it will do extremely well.
That's true.
You know, I highly doubt it would make $1 billion like Joker. Although even Joker at the same time seemed like that was shot in the dark. It's kind of crazy how that made $1 billion, even just knowing what that movie is.
Right.
But
it's still the Joker.
But it's still the Joker.
When you think comic book villains, that's the first one you think of.
And Harley Quinn's maybe not up to, definitely not up to that stature.
But she is, you know, almost Deadpool type stature.
Yes.
Like, popularity of a character. Mm-hmm. And that's a popular ass character. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. But I really hope that just all around, just as a movie and financially, I hope this thing's a success. I hope it's good. But
Well, I was going to say, I don't think that the other film we're talking about is going to get to, man, I would be surprised with that trailer if it makes it to like $250 million.
Let's dive a little deeper on our good pal Michael Morbius.
Is that his name?
His actual name, which would be fine in the context of, like, if this is a character in, you know, a Spider-Man
film.
Movie. It's like, oh, Michael Morbius, that's a dumbass name.
Yeah.
It's like Bucky Barnes. Like,
A lot of superhero names from, you know, back in the day, they're kind of dumb.
But no, you're going to give a whole, you know,
a whole movie
to this character, to Michael Morbius. Let's care about
and
Michael
to Jared
Morbius.
Leto.
To Jared Leto.
Which, Jared Leto, you know, say what you will, he's a fine actor. I've never actually seen Dallas Buyers Club, the one that he won that Oscar for.
Probably.
I'm sure he's brilliant in it.
It's the best performance he's ever given.
Yeah, and I mean, I have a soft spot for his inclusion in American Psycho.
Yes.
But as a whole, I do not like Jared Leto. I don't like his persona.
You just made me realize that, like, my main experiences watching him as an actor has been a film where he just gets his head bashed in, a film where he plays a very shitty version of the Joker, and this, like, knockout performance that was like, whoa, I first saw that. It's like, that's such a weird, that's just such a strange career.
Mm-hmm.
Like, his career is so weird.
And not a 30 Seconds to Mars fan at all.
No.
Don't have much great things to say.
I've never watched Requiem for a Dream, so maybe he's great in that. But I don't know. Just like,
I wouldn't know either.
What a strange man. And now he's in this film, which just was just a bad idea since, like, it was announced.
It's actually kind of funny, the two connections both of these films share with Suicide Squad. You know, obviously
exactly.
Harley Quinn coming from Suicide Squad, and then Jared Leto being that Joker in that movie to now being in Morbius, you know, another comic book movie, which also just, I don't know, knowing what, who, like, how Jared Leto is, it feels weird that he would take a film role like this, like Morbius.
I could see it, actually. Yeah. I feel like with this, to me, this almost reads like he got kind of, like, in his opinion, like, fucked over from his last attempt at a comic franchise. And I think he is maybe kind of approaching this with, I'm going to be a part of something that is noticeably bigger.
Yeah.
Now being, having ties to the MCU, and is just kind of going for it. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, probably finds that role kind of appealing. Yeah. That he could, like, you know, do some really creative stuff with it.
And also being just the title character and having him, I mean, it's not like they're going to cut out 90% of his stuff like they did in Suicide Squad. He's the thing.
So it's like, I get it. Like, I kind of get it where he's coming from on that.
I'm looking it up now, who's directing this film. I guess it's the guy's, which one's Life? The movie Life, do you remember that one?
I do.
That space movie with Jake Gyllenhaal and Ryan Reynolds?
Yeah.
I guess he directed that. That's not really making me feel too great about this one. That and a movie called Safe House with Denzel Washington.
I remember that too, and that was kind of...
Someone else? Two movies that not too inspired, both with like 60% on Rotten Tomatoes, so not very, kind of middle of the road kind of movies.
And they both look generic in their trailers. I'm like recalling now the trailers to both of those movies, and that's actually the same exact way I felt about this Morbius trailer. It just looks so generic. It looks like it should have came out in 2003, right? 2004.
It kind of reminds me of like, this could have been what Blade Trinity was or something. Sure. Like, if you put Wesley Snipes in that trailer, I would believe it to be Blade Trinity.
Right.
And not, not that I have any connection to Morbius or know anything really about that character, but, it's just so weird. It feels like a... I don't even know why Morbius. I feel like if they're gonna do movies about Marvel or, you know, Spider-Man villains that they can choose from, I feel like there are definitely better options.
Oh, absolutely.
Sandman or Green Goblin, or I don't know if they could do Kingpin, since like Marvel might have that from like Daredevil rights. I don't know how that works.
There was speculation for a while about a Silver Sable Black Cat movie, which is like, even that would actually kind of be more, I feel like would have more of an appeal.
Yeah.
And like would, more people would care, and it's just more interesting characters, kind of, even though one's just sort of like a Catwoman knockoff, and the other one is just like this spy lady, just pretty much the same as Black Widow, essentially, but more evil.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know, just the idea of doing these characters in their own films is just stupid. And now that they have this, Sony is basically regaining the rights back for Spider-Man, it's just kind of like, why even pursue a project like this anymore?
Yeah.
It's like you could just have these characters be a part of the overall narrative in a Spider-Man movie. It doesn't have to be a whole movie devoted to this character.
Yeah.
And it's like really just, I don't know, it just kind of like messes things up for how the story can be told. Because like I'm predicting right now their Venom inclusion is going to be some story where the symbiote abandons Eddie Brock and then he ends up going on Spider-Man, because of course I'm sure Sony wants to do Black Costume Spider-Man again, especially with Tom Holland. Tom Holland realizes it's evil, the symbiote goes away, goes back to Eddie Brock, then they have a feud. Like, I'm just calling it right now, that's going to be the movie.
Yeah, setting up a Batman versus Superman kind of thing, trying to do something similar to that, I assume.
But it's like, you don't really have to worry about that anymore. It's like, I feel like they've patched things up to where they're, you know, connected, obviously. Mm-hmm. It's just like, just have him appear in Spider-Man 4 or something. What the hell? Like, this does not warrant a whole movie.
No, it really doesn't. I don't get it. And again, like you said, it doesn't look great. I'm reading here on the Wikipedia that Tyrese Gibson has signed a 3-picture deal with this movie.
Yeah,
which I've heard about is that. Weird. Like, okay, I guess he's gonna show up again in future Spider-Man spin-off
in
movies.
Morbius 2.
Yeah, this seems just unwarranted.
Yeah,
unwanted. I honestly don't know who is really out there who wants this.
Yeah. It's just, it's completely pointless now.
Yeah.
Maybe, if anything, now with Sony and Marvel kind of coming together a bit on Spider-Man, maybe that'll just, like, stop any, like, future installments of, you know, just lone character Spider-Man movies. I feel like that deal that Tyrese Gibson signed is probably just for, like, maybe, like, the Sinister Six movie that's supposed to happen, and maybe, like, an appearance in, like, a future Spider-Man movie.
Well, probably, like, Venom 2.
I feel like it's more than likely something like that, because there's no way in hell that just the character of Morbius will be such a hit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, two or three movies about that one character.
I guess they're probably trying to capture the Blade phenomenon, but I don't think it's gonna happen. It's not gonna be. It's not gonna be Blade.
Not to mention you're gonna have an actual Blade movie coming out very soon.
Well, maybe then they could do Morbius versus Blade.
I mean, hey,
if there is some, you know, cross modulation between Marvel Studios and the Sony stuff, who knows? But I feel like this movie's gonna bomb.
Oh yeah,
and they'll forget it forever.
Jared Leto is gonna take to Twitter and he's gonna be like, "They cut it on my good."
No, they didn't.
No, they didn't.
They're probably gonna make a very mediocre film.
Mm-hmm. Oh, one thing before we get off the topic of superhero movies and stuff like that, did you hear the rumors that apparently with the whole Netflix shows kind of like being a part of the MCU now that Matt Murdock might show up in the next Spider-Man movie?
Oh, really?
Yeah, like they might bring, there's a huge rumor.
Did they wrangle the Netflix stuff into their universe?
Yeah, this deal went through, I forget what happened exactly. From what I heard, it was sped along, so now those characters can pop up in future MCU films.
Wow.
So yeah, there's a huge rumor that Charlie Cox will be Matt Murdock, will play Matt Murdock, and he'll be Peter Parker's, like, defense attorney in that movie.
Oh, that would be really cool. Great. Oh my god, that makes so much sense.
Yeah.
That's a really cool thing.
I hope that happens.
I really hope that happens.
Even more so, I hope they get Jon Bernthal. Like, maybe Spider-Man's, like, a hunted man in the third one.
Oh, shit. Yeah, that would make sense.
Like, tries to take him out, and then Daredevil comes in.
Yeah.
Like, Just you know, dreaming. But hey, hopefully that happens. That'd be really cool.
That's you know, you should be the writer at Marvel. Because that'll honestly, with how the end of Far From Home finishes up, you know, that all makes sense.
Yeah.
Especially if they're trying to rush that deal ahead so that they can get, you know, rights for those characters.
Exactly.
Like, that makes sense.
So, yeah. Was just a little rumor I heard this week, and I'm like, that is sick. I really hope that happens,
because
that would be, that'd be amazing to see all those characters together.
And then hope to see Vincent D'Onofrio again for Kingpin.
I would love that. That would be a great plot if that was like a thing. Like, you know, maybe Kingpin's the villain. He's like, puts out a hit or something on him. Like, that'd be pretty dope.
That'd be really cool.
We'll see what happens. Hopefully that is true. But going from one end of Hollywood to a complete other, well, to a point, because there's one that actually is tied to the world of superhero movies in a way.
Mm-hmm.
We are going to talk about the 2020 Oscar nominations that were announced this week. A lot to talk about with that.
Where do you want to start?
So, basically, just to let listeners know how we're going to approach this, we're basically going to go through just categories that we feel are maybe the most important
some of the bigger
to talk
ones.
About. Kind of go into what we think the Academy is going to pick, but what we would personally pick in these categories.
From the nominations specifically?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, so what are our best guesses, and like that is probably going to win, and then what we genuinely want.
All right.
Which, I think for Best Picture, I feel like we're probably going to agree on that one.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. If you listen to our Best Films podcast, I'm sure Which, I'm sure you'll figure that out.
If that movie actually wins, I will die happy. Yeah. Like, I would be so shocked by that. But before that, before we get in depth on this, on our picks and what our guesstimated Academy picks, mm-hmm. How do you feel about the nominations this year?
I think kind of standard, I guess. A lot of what I expected. Sure. A couple snubs, a couple big ones.
Major ones. Absolutely.
Obviously, the biggest one for the two of us is going to be Uncut Gems.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually read an article the other day from someone who's in the Academy, some character actor or something, who has some insight into, you know, how things get decided on and picked and nominated. And despite Adam Sandler's big hype and build-up, you know, leading into the Oscar nominations, the guy said that it could have been due to Sandler being so arrogant, or arrogant in the past, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
As well as, like, just knowing, you know, all the people in the Academy have to watch so many movies, and you know, I'm certain a number of them were like, I don't want to watch an Adam Sandler movie. I don't care how good you say it is, you know.
Sure.
So I guess that's probably, you know, that's kind of what I expected it to be. That's kind of what I assume happened with Uncut Gems, where it was kind of too late, and didn't really garner the build up for a lot of the, especially probably older Academy members.
And I feel like the Safdies, their filmmaking style just does not resonate with a lot of the people that are a part of the Academy.
Yeah.
I honestly feel like their material is like maybe a bit too young for a lot of the people seeing
maybe
these movies. Because like, I feel like, I don't know, just like certain scenes and just like, just their whole style and aesthetic as a whole, just from what I've noticed, like, just, I feel like it resonates way more with, like, our generation
yeah.
than a lot of people that are picking this, the films that are nominated. And it's unfortunate.
Yeah.
But I, at the same time, like, while I do think that's a thing, this film has obviously really brought a lot of attention to the Safdies.
Mm-hmm.
This film has so much attention, it's going to get even more attention because it was announced this week that Uncut Gems is coming to Netflix
uh-huh.
by, I believe, the end of this month.
End of this month internationally. I think it's like January 31st internationally. And then the rumor is that it's coming to the U.S. In February.
There we go.
So yeah, I don't know if that's actually certain. I know that like A24 in the past has had a deal with Amazon Prime
mm-hmm.
Where all their films after their DVD releases will eventually go to Amazon, but apparently Netflix had some deal with Uncut Gems and maybe produced a bit of it or put some money into it. So
sure, so
it'd be interesting to see.
Yeah, it may be exposed to an even larger amount of people
yeah.
who
yeah.
obviously have heard about this movie. So yeah, in the long run, it's unfortunate. It's one of those things that I was kind of afraid would happen,
mm-hmm.
and it did. But I think in the long run, it's still been really good for all parties involved
yeah.
and obviously is getting the attention it deserves everywhere else
yeah.
except
yeah.
here, unfortunately.
Yeah. It's too bad because it is, like, the biggest stage. It's, you know, I would have loved for the Safdies to have gotten
yeah.
a nomination, whether it be, you know, for Sandler or for editing or, some, you know, soundtrack, you know, all the great parts that make up this movie.
Especially soundtrack.
Yeah.
That would have been amazing to see one of Thurks get a nomination for that, and I was expecting him to, but
yeah,
sadly no luck. And then another gigantic snub, except for, we'll touch upon it when we go through the categories, they did get one nomination there, but The Lighthouse,
yeah,
which is
I expected that to not
really
be anywhere really,
but I was very much hoping that Willem Dafoe would get a Best Supporting Actor
yeah.
nomination.
Same here.
I think his performance in that is one of the best of this year,
mm-hmm.
and really would have loved to have seen him get at least an acknowledgement.
Yeah,
nice,
and
that was a performance that really warranted
and
it.
He gets more than like what a typical supporting role gets.
Right.
I feel like he's in a lot of that movie. Although I guess I would say most of the actors in the supporting category are probably pretty. You know, they're in a lot of their respective films as well. But I don't
yeah.
know that we necessarily needed Joe Pesci and Al Pacino from The Irishman
much,
in that
yeah.
category. But at the same time, it's like, you know, two really fine actors from an old age coming back for maybe one last hurrah, especially for Pesci.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, kind of deserved.
I almost would be okay with him getting that if that's the case.
Yeah.
That would actually be kind of awesome.
Yeah.
Just because, like, I feel like he's probably not going to do anything else after this.
Yeah, I kind of doubt that as well.
Do you have any other prominent snubs that come to mind?
Nothing coming to mind, I don't think. One big surprise, and we'll talk about it when we get to Best Picture, is Jojo Rabbit.
Yes.
Coming out in a lot of places.
That's what I was going to bring up, actually. That was one really good thing
mm-hmm.
from this year's picks that just I am so happy to see acknowledged.
Yeah,
Jojo Rabbit.
It's crazy.
I did not see that coming at all. It's such a wonderful film. Mm-hmm. And yeah, if you would have told me that Jojo Rabbit would get a Best Picture nominee over Uncut Gems, I would have been like, you're funny.
Yeah,
like, there's
right.
no way. There's no way they're actually going to give attention to this film. And sure enough.
There it is. So you want to get into it? Do you want to start anywhere specific?
Do you have the, how are you looking at this? Do you have, like, the Oscars website?
Yeah, I have the Oscars website.
Well, just take it in order as, like, we see fit. We could skip
roll,
over.
Roll down the list.
We don't really...
Yeah.
Maybe, like, because I know the animated one, I've not seen enough films in that list.
Yeah, I actually have Missing Link in my, well, not in
sick.
Here, but it's out there. I rented that from the library the other day. I'm looking forward to watching that finally.
I've been really wanting to see that.
But yeah, let's start with Best Picture here.
Cool.
So going down the list, it's 9 nominees this year. Obviously, they can do 10, which again makes it sad that Uncut Gems didn't make it, since they keep leaving out a movie, I feel like, every year. They extended the list from 5 to 10 a handful of years ago, but I don't think we've ever even seen the 10 nominations since they extended it. But starting off, we got Ford versus Ferrari, which I don't think either of us actually saw.
No.
And actually, that's the only one of all of them I didn't see. But then we have The Irishman, Jojo Rabbit, Joker, Little Women, Marriage Story, 1917, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and, of course, Parasite.
Yep.
Having seen most of these movies except for Ford vs. Ferrari, which I have a big doubt will, you know, even come close to winning this.
Looking at this list, yeah, Ford vs. Ferrari and Little Women are the only ones I have not seen on this list.
Yeah. I think Parasite should win.
I 110% agree.
I believe that Once Upon a Time is going to take it. Honestly.
That is exactly what I'm expecting, too. Because I have a theory about the way the awards are going to come
mm-hmm.
out. Mainly for Best Director and Best Picture. I feel like the Academy has never given Tarantino an award.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like they're going to do that for this one. I don't think he's going to get Best Director. I'm going to touch on the other end of that theory when we get to that subject. But I think this is going to be the year they acknowledge Tarantino.
Yeah, I think Once Upon a Time has... people are assuming or expecting 1917 to get it because it won Best Drama at the Golden Globes.
Right.
Having seen that movie recently, which we will get into later, I personally don't think it should win. But I also, I don't know, I don't think that movie has enough to win the Best Oscar or Best Picture. Whereas I think Once Upon a Time in Hollywood really reaches a total audience, you know, especially all these Academy people who live in L.A., who probably a majority of them have lived in that era, you know, in the late 60s, you know, probably have a big connection to it. And obviously it's a fantastic film. It's wonderfully directed and all the acting is superb. It's really got everything you want out of a Tarantino movie. And
it does. In a way, it's almost unintentional Oscar bait because, yeah, it's
mm-hmm.
like a great point that you made that, you know, this is a film about Hollywood.
About them,
and, the Academy, I mean, that's obviously what it's all about, but this film is just a love letter to all.
Yeah.
This is Tarantino's I'm going to wear my I'm a film nerd mm-hmm. badge on my sleeve.
Yep.
Film. And that's I would be very okay with that getting that. It's a great film. Obviously when you see your favorite movie of the year pop up on a list like this, it's like you really want that. Yeah. I would be thrilled if Parasite ended up getting that, because I think that would be such an important achievement for foreign films in America.
Yes.
I wish that, and maybe they will, but I wish the Academy could actually make a strive for that and do something like that, because that is a lot of influence that they have. Yeah. And it could expose a lot of people to this movie. So it is their duty to do something like that, but I don't think they will, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But I could be wrong.
I'm hoping for, like, a Shape of Water moment here. Where, yeah. like, you know, in 2018, when Shape of Water took home Best Picture, that was eye-opening to me. And then, like even Moonlight the year before. Yeah. Like, these movies that, you know, I feel like would hit a smaller crowd, but then end up taking home the big prize. I would love to see Parasite, like you said. I think it is easily the best film of this year, and honestly one of the best of the decade.
Oh, absolutely.
It's just a phenomenal film and deserves it. I don't think the Academy will go there.
No.
Unfortunately, in the past, it feels like international films just don't really get a chance. It's at least good to see it nominated.
Exactly.
But yeah, I don't think it'll get it.
Neither.
Branching off of that, you probably weren't going to touch upon international film too much. But I do think that will obviously take international film.
It will.
I mean, it's kind of obvious if it was nominated in international film and also got best overall picture of the year, like it's kind of a shoo-in to win
right.
international, so.
So at least there's that, and that's, yeah. that's cool.
The crazier part is that it's the first South Korean film to ever get nominated in the Best International category.
Really?
Which is wild to me. Being
That's very wild.
I'm a huge fan of South Korean cinema, and there's so many I could pick from, you know.
Right.
So many. And somehow this is the first out of, you know, 89, 90, however many years they've been doing the Oscars.
That's ludicrous. That is absolutely
but
ridiculous.
It's, you know, it's pretty crazy, you know, that it's also up for Best Picture then.
Yeah.
It's the first time an international South Korean film has ever been nominated and it's already up for Best Picture, so that's cool to see.
That is really cool.
Moving on, we're gonna go into the actor in a leading role. And going down that list, that is Antonio Banderas from the film Pain and Glory, Leonardo DiCaprio from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Adam Driver in Marriage Story, Joaquin Phoenix in Joker, and Jonathan Pryce in The Two Popes. For this one, I would personally give it to Adam Driver in Marriage Story, but I definitely think Joaquin's going to take it home for Joker.
I would give it to Adam Driver. Joaquin is going to get it. I think it's kind of a given, but I am thoroughly okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
I think his performance in that movie is great. I think he did an amazing job in that film. I think his level of dedication to that film was very impressive. Yeah. And I like Joaquin Phoenix. Mm-hmm. I think he deserves that award. He's deserved it before and has been phenomenal in other things, but I think just his level of commitment to this role was extremely impressive. And I think he totally deserves it. But Adam Driver gave a hell of a performance in Marriage Story.
Yes, he
acted
did.
His ass off in that movie. And I feel like if there wasn't anything like Joaquin, I feel like he would have been a shoo-in, I think.
Yeah.
Because I feel like if Joaquin's Joker performance didn't exist, they probably would have gave it to DiCaprio, maybe, over Adam Driver.
Yeah.
Which is...
I mean, I don't know. I haven't seen Pain and Glory or The Two Popes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure both of those performances are excellent, but, if Joaquin wasn't there for Joker, you know, who... Maybe De Niro could have been in this category.
That's true.
And he maybe probably could have won.
That was a great performance.
You know, his really great performance in The Irishman.
You know, now that you bring that up, I'm honestly kind of surprised that he was snubbed in this category.
It's tough.
Like, I haven't seen, like you said, Two Popes or Pain and Glory. But, I mean, like, I feel like Antonio Banderas would have wound up there. I don't know who Jonathan Pryce really even is, or, like, what his performance in that movie was.
But yeah, I haven't heard, like, anything about the Two Popes, really.
It's kind of out of nowhere.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like, I'm kind of surprised that he made it over De Niro, but, yeah.
I think Jonathan Pryce is the star of Brazil. You ever seen Terry Gilliam's Brazil? Yeah, I'm not really too... don't really know Jonathan Pryce too well outside of that film, but I definitely think Joaquin will take it home. That role has been just on the, you know, on everyone's lips this year.
So yeah,
I definitely think that will take it. And actually, I think a lot of the acting, nominations here and in each of the categories, I think it's kind of each one has its own shoe in. Mm-hmm. More or less. So leading on, we're going into actress in a leading role, and we have Cynthia Erivo from Harriet, Scarlett Johansson from Marriage Story, Saoirse Ronan from Little Women, Charlize Theron from Bombshell, and Renee Zellweger in Judy. What they're saying is Charlize Theron is kind of the shoe-in for this one. Having not seen Bombshell, Harriet, or Judy,
yeah,
I don't really have too much to give on this one. I guess you probably haven't seen the only one you've probably seen is Marriage Story, since you haven't seen Little Women.
I haven't seen Little Women.
I thought Saoirse was great in Little Women, but for this category, I would definitely go with Scarlett Johansson.
Same. And even though that is the only film I've seen from this list, I think she gave an incredible performance.
Yeah.
For expectations, for some reason I get a strange feeling they're going to give it to Renee Zellweger for Judy. I don't know why.
That's just like old Hollywood.
I could just see that being their pick, but I really hope it is Charlize Theron, and I would love to see her get that award because I love her.
I'm sure she's excellent in that movie.
Yeah.
And I think Scarlett was honestly one of the best performances I saw out of any actor, gender, whatever.
Yeah.
This year, so
she was incredible in Marriage Story.
Leading on, we've got actor in a supporting role, that includes Tom Hanks as Mr. Rogers in A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, Anthony Hopkins again with The Two Popes. We have a twofer with Al Pacino and Joe Pesci with The Irishman, and Brad Pitt for his performance in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. For this one, I would both say that I expect and want Brad Pitt for Once Upon a Time.
Really? I'm going to stick with what I said earlier. I want Joe Pesci to win, just because that'd be really awesome.
It would be nice, but I think he's, I don't know, he's not in too much of that. He's in a lot of it, actually. I don't know, I just thought Brad Pitt was phenomenal in Once Upon a Time.
No, yeah, Brad Pitt I expect to win,
yeah.
And he absolutely deserves it.
Yeah.
He was serious, I think, maybe even more of a highlight for that film than DiCaprio.
Yeah.
He 100% deserves it. And he was great in that film. But yeah, no, I just think it'd be kind of fun to see Joe Pesci acknowledged.
Yeah. I wonder if he's ever actually gotten a nomination or won anything at the Oscars before, but
yeah. Pretty stacked list with us too, especially with Tom Hanks.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Rogers.
Yeah, I assume,
but that would be
he was Mr. Rogers. He was really great in it. I thought Tom Hanks was really excellent in A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, and I assume Anthony Hopkins is also really great in The Two Popes, but man, if that was Willem Dafoe in that category instead of him.
I really wish.
Moving on, we have actress in a supporting role, and that includes Kathy Bates from Richard Jewell, Laura Dern in Marriage Story, a surprise pick with Scarlett Johansson in Jojo Rabbit, Florence Pugh in Little Women, and Margot Robbie in Bombshell. For this one, I would go with Laura Dern as what I expect will win.
Mm-hmm.
Although, I really loved Scarlett Johansson and Jojo Rabbit.
She was great.
It's tough. I think, man, what I would want, I think I might actually go with Scarlett again.
Me too.
Although I think Laura Dern was obviously excellent in Marriage Story. I really just connected with Scarlett's character in Jojo Rabbit.
She was great.
I think maybe the downfall with her inclusion is that she is a very minimal part in that movie.
But when she's in it, it's very impactful.
Yeah.
She has like some of the best scenes in that film, yeah. Actually.
Definitely agree. I assume, you know, Margot Robbie and Kathy Bates are probably excellent in their respective roles, but Florence Pugh was also standout in Little Women.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough list, but
who do you expect them to give the award to?
I definitely think Laura Dern will get it.
You think so?
Yeah.
I get a weird feeling about Kathy Bates maybe getting that.
Yeah. That would be really cool to see.
It's so random. Also, just that's kind of the only award that Richard Jewell has been nominated mm-hmm. for, and like something to me just reads that like maybe that's like they're going with her
yeah.
for that role. But my Academy prediction, I'm gonna go Kathy Bates.
Yeah. All right. We're gonna skip over animated, right? Since we probably haven't seen too many.
Yeah, I'm looking at that.
I haven't seen any of them except for Toy Story 4. Although same. I did start Claws the other day. And man, that's a really excellently animated film. Just the way it looks is really something special.
I'll have to check that out. Missing Link, I really want to see.
Yes.
I've never seen a How to Train Your Dragon movie.
I haven't either. I know. I feel like that's something I've missed out on. I feel like I should check those out.
Same.
They're so beloved.
And it's like, anytime I hear somebody talk about them, it's always, oh my god, it's the best. It's like the best animated franchise going on. So
Since we're here, I expected to go to Toy Story.
Yeah.
I think that's the most obvious choice. Although Missing Link won at the Golden Globes, so who knows? Maybe it has a chance.
That'd be really cool.
Moving on, we wanted to get into cinematography, which leaves us with The Irishman. That would be Rodrigo Prieto. Joker by Lawrence Scherr, The Lighthouse by Jaron Blaschke, 1917, whose cinematographer was Roger Deakins, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which was Robert Richardson. Man, it's so good to see The Lighthouse in this list.
It really is.
And honestly,
some form of acknowledgement.
I would want that to win. I bet 1917 takes this home.
That's
it's Roger Deakins. Like that's kind of. That's his forte, you know, he's one of the most recognizable names in cinematography today, and 1917 was a phenomenal looking film.
Yeah, and also just the way it was put together.
Yeah.
Having primarily, you know, being, you know, one extended
long take.
I feel like just on that merit alone, they're probably going to give him the award.
Yeah, I think Roger Deakins takes this easily.
I would love to see the 110s nightmare that is The Lighthouse win that film.
Yeah, I think that has the second best shot at this, I would say, after 1917.
One of the most original-looking films I've seen in recent memory.
Even more so than 1917, I think it is absolutely. Just, like, so striking to look at.
Because
like,
nobody has tried to make a film like that in the modern era.
Right, and to so just so well capture the look, feel, look and feel of like early 1900s cinema.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something so phenomenal. And actually I own the Blu-ray. I bought the Blu-ray a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, that's
and watched,
awesome.
I haven't watched the film again, but I did watch the little documentary they have on there, like the 40-minute documentary that they have, and they include the cinematographer in that, and they have some questions that they ask him, and just hearing more about how they had to create this film, you know, having no one really having experience with shooting a film like that.
Yeah.
It was really interesting, especially with like all the scenes where they did like low light and it was all like organic, you know, candlelit scenes and stuff like that. And man, what a what a special movie. I would love to see that take it home, but I definitely think 1917 will get it.
It probably will be.
It's also probably like 1917 was probably seen by 95% of the Academy, and The Lighthouse was probably seen by like 20. It's a big difference there. I would assume.
Yeah, having just rewatched The Lighthouse, gotta give a huge shout out again to that film. What a great film.
Yeah.
And that even more, you know, more it's why I want that to get picked.
Yeah.
After having just rewatched it again, it's just so good.
Yeah. Moving on, we're going to skip over costume design for time's sake and go into directing.
Yep.
We have Martin Scorsese for The Irishman, The Joker with Todd Phillips, 1917's Sam Mendes, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood for Quentin Tarantino, and Bong Joon-ho for Parasite. Again, really great to see Bong Joon-ho get some recognition and have Parasite be recognized like that.
Mm-hmm.
For me, man, I kind of see this going to Scorsese.
Really? Over Sam Mendes? I think Sam Mendes is getting it.
I mean, man, I don't know.
That's the other part
of it. I feel like 1917 is more of a cinematographer's film. You know, in that way, rather than like a director's film, because that movie kind of hinges itself so much upon its, you know, one long take and one cut thing. I could definitely see Sam Mendes kind of falling in that regard, and then Martin Scorsese making this huge epic, this 3.5 hour movie where everything is so picture perfect, you know, in this era, and the work that he gets out of his actors, like, this is, you know, I kind of see Scorsese getting it here.
Actually, Scorsese is my pick that I actually want to get it for this.
I definitely want Bong Joon-ho.
Like, I obviously want him to as well, but I feel like for what this movie is, for as long, like, this, as long and ambitious of an epic it is, it's just so impressive on that. Merits
and,
me
and could be Scorsese's so swan well. Song, you know, like this could be like the end of all of their careers.
That's
really,
true,
you know.
So I actually do want Scorsese to take that, but my prediction is still Sam Mendes. I feel like, because that was a part of my theory with director film, it's like I feel like the Academy, just judging by the level of nominations that both these films have got, they need to acknowledge one or the other. I think they're going to get Sam Mendes for director, because I feel also like, I just think like they kind of want to give that Best Picture as well, but I feel like that will go to Once Upon a Time. So they're basically going to do that here and then give Tarantino for Best Film.
I definitely don't think Todd Phillips deserves to be in this list.
No.
I will say that right now. He does really. That's just, you know, the hype that movie has built over the last 4 months. I really don't understand how Joker has the most nominations out of any movie with 11. I don't think it's going to win any except for Joaquin's performance.
Pretty much.
Maybe soundtrack. Maybe, because I actually do remember the soundtrack actually being pretty good. But I don't get it. But obviously I'm very biased in this category, or speaking specifically to Joker, but.
Right.
I would love Bong Joon-ho to take it, but I kind of expect it to go to Martin.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know. Like, that would be cool. If it went to either Bong or Martin, like, I'm cool with either of those. I think they definitely deserve it. But, no, I get a weird feeling that 1917 is going to take both director and cinematography.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think Sam Mendes might get it. But we'll see. It'll be interesting to see how this all plays out.
Yeah. Before we get out of here, I think we should at least talk about one of the screenplay categories, if not both. Let's do both.
Sure.
So for writing adapted screenplay here first, we're going, we have screenplay by Steven Zaillian for The Irishman, Taika Waititi's Jojo Rabbit, Joker written by Todd Phillips and somebody else whose name doesn't pop up when I...
Scott Silver.
Scott Silver. Okay, it wasn't showing up on mine. Little Women, written for the screen by, I assume, is Greta Gerwig. It does, again, it's cutting off. And then The Two Popes, written by Anthony McCarten. Here I think The Irishman takes this one.
Yeah.
And also that's probably what I would pick as well.
I want Taika to get it.
I do. Let's yeah. Go, Taika. Yeah, I would love to see Taika get it. I don't think that's gonna happen.
It's not gonna happen.
But again, another like any of the nominations for Jojo Rabbit are completely out of nowhere for me. I feel like that movie kind of came and went.
Yeah.
For the most part.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, people seeing it and then enjoying it, and obviously we really enjoyed it, but...
It was kind of like only just fans of his. Like,
yeah.
It wasn't necessarily getting... I mean, obviously it was getting good reviews, but it wasn't... I feel like it wasn't necessarily resonating with people that wouldn't already go see a Taika Waititi film, you know?
It's kind of crazy that it's there. And it's also kind of crazy to me that Joker is there, because twice. I think that movie is... not well written at all, but again, that's my own bias. But yeah, I would say give it to The Irishman, and that's what I kind of expect. Although yeah, although that. Maybe Little Women, takes it for this one actually.
I can see
seeing
that
as
too.
How that's gotten a good amount of nominations, and I don't think it'll win anything else.
That could be it.
Well, maybe like makeup and hairstyling or something if it got nominated for that. But yeah, I definitely think Little Women could have a shot for a screenplay here.
Absolutely.
But then moving into the more interesting category, I think, for screenplay, for original screenplay, we have Rian Johnson's Knives Out, which it's nice to see that get nominated somewhere. Noah Baumbach's Marriage Story. 1917, which is written by Sam Mendes and
Christy Wilson Cairns.
All right.
Cairns, yeah.
Because that's cut off on mine.
Yeah.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, written by Quentin Tarantino, and Parasite, written by Bong Joon-ho and somebody else.
Han Jin-won.
All right. Man, I would definitely give it to Parasite, because I think that's the best written film of the year.
That'd be my pick as well.
I think, don't really know why 1917's here.
I don't either. I definitely think Noah Baumbach's going to take it for this.
Man, I don't know. I think Quentin probably will take this one. Actually, I think that's a really well-written movie.
Yeah, it is.
And Quentin Tarantino obviously has a knack for writing exceptional dialogue, and that movie is carried by a lot of that. So I honestly think Quentin will take it for Once Upon a Time, although Marriage Story would probably be my second expectation.
I think that's kind of the one place where this is going to get really acknowledged.
Yeah, yeah.
That's...
Unless Scarlett takes home Best Actress, but I
kind of doubt that.
Yeah. But yeah, again, Parasite, obviously, honestly, for me, give Parasite every award it's nominated for. I kind of wish there would have been some actor nods for Parasite.
That'd
I would have
nice.
Loved the father in that film to get like a supporting role.
That would have been great.
But, you know, we couldn't even get Willem Dafoe. So, and also, the Academy always has a stigma against international actors. Like, ever putting international films, actors into those categories.
Which
so
is completely bogus.
Yeah. But again, it's really great to see Knives Out here.
Yeah.
Shout out to Rian Johnson. That's a phenomenal whodunit story and really well written.
Absolutely.
But again, I don't understand why 1917's here. But we'll get into that a little bit more.
Absolutely.
In a moment here. So yeah, that was our little rundown of the Oscars pre-show.
Absolutely.
I don't know. I think the Oscars air the 2nd of... No. I think the 2nd of February is the Super Bowl. And the Oscars is... on February 9th, the week after. So
we'll have more to talk about then too.
Yeah, we'll definitely touch in that, you know, when that episode comes. But yeah.
Till then.
Look out for the Oscars. Yeah, speculate. Maybe send in your own expectations and who you would want to take home these awards. Yeah.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to... talk about that aforementioned 1917 with Sam Mendes.
Be right back.
Welcome back to Infinite Canvas Ultra. So, yeah, continuing on with our movie talk that we've been doing this whole episode. I like this. It's been nice. It's been nice recapping.
We don't talk about movies enough here.
Right. If there's anything this show needed, it's more movie talk.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, we've been talking a lot about 1917 by Sam Mendes. It had, I believe, 10 nominations in total.
10 total Academy Award nominations. Second most, I think, to Joker. Yeah.
Which is, it's very interesting. There's a massive level of hype surrounding this movie. Mm-hmm. Couldn't have come at a better time for this film, in all seriousness, how it had its wide release, I think, maybe a week after all of these nominations came out.
It might have been, like, the same week, yeah, I think.
So, perfect timing. I feel like it's generating a lot more buzz for this film than it initially had, which it already had a lot going into it, with just huge levels of great praise and a lot of acknowledgments for its cinematography, direction, the way the film is presented to you, the audience. And yeah, we just caught it this week, and we're going to talk about it a little bit. What are some of your biggest takeaways from 1917?
It's kind of, to me, it's like Dunkirk, but if I enjoyed it more, you know? Yeah, like, no, it's
absolutely.
1917 strikes me as a film that is kind of harking off of Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk and kind of what that was going for. Whereas I thought Dunkirk was kind of dreadfully boring and impersonal.
One of the things that this film hits you with right away and actually takes away one of my biggest criticisms about Dunkirk, and one of the things that I liked least about it was, yes, you have obviously the battles going on and that's engaging, but the people that I'm seeing on screen, the characters that you're giving me, I have no connection with whatsoever. Yeah. And it really deflates the experience of that film for me for some reason.
Yeah.
A lot of people love Dunkirk, and a lot of people love it because they view it as this very visceral, you're thrown into a battle type scenario type of film, and that's great, but
that movie's not,
it's just not achieved well. It's just in terms of just its overall experience. I mean, it looks great, it's visually beautiful, but it just doesn't have an emotional impact to it.
Whereas here with 1917, Sam Mendes has created two characters who you really end up caring for a lot, I think, by the end of the movie. So 1917, obviously, takes place during World War I with two young British soldiers. And we travel with them as they're sent on this death-defying, you know, suicide mission where they're, you know, they have to travel across the no man's land and, you know, through all these different German-occupied towns to try to get to this this troop that is about to do an attack on the Germans, and they find out, the British command finds out that it's, you know, it's some kind of trap, and so they send these two kids, basically, like, you know, they've got to be like 19.
Yeah.
They send them out to try and stop this battle, this trying to stop this attack from going, or else, you know, the British are expected to lose thousands of men. And, you know, whereas Dunkirk really shifted its view to all these different characters that you kind of only got to spend a little bit of time with, 1917, you are with these two characters from start to finish. Exactly. I don't, like, it really doesn't take the camera off of them the entire time.
Not at all. It's like you're running in with them.
Yeah.
And the experience of watching it is just as kind of harrowing and unexpected as it would be going on a mission like that.
It's kind of incredible. It's almost like the camera itself is the third man with them, you know, just watching and traveling with them. It feels very personal. A lot of the camera work is very, like I said, very personal and up close, and it feels right there with them.
Yeah,
like that heightens the entire experience.
Like, you as a viewer, you don't know whether to expect, you know, coming across bullets getting shot at you or razor wire traps that you have to go around with. It's presented to you as they're experiencing it, which is very unique for a war film and just very nice and just kind of makes it a cut above what other films in this genre are like.
And as much as I have a, I don't know, I have an interesting dilemma with this movie where I thought it was exceptionally well made. I loved looking at it. There's a scene towards the middle where, you know, the characters are traveling through this town during the nighttime, and it's like all lit by like these fires, and it just looks amazing. But at the same time, I just expected more from the action, I guess. It was, again, similar to like something like Dunkirk, where it's this very visceral experience, and it feels heavy and real, but it just didn't, again, with that, it didn't really come off as like a very exciting or fun to watch war movie.
Right, like it's entertaining for sure, but it just does not. This is not necessarily a film I really would ever revisit or really ever watch again. I just think it's kind of hard, at least for me personally, with this genre, with the war film, for me to like really heavily invest myself in it too much, or for it to portray a story that I deeply care about to like level like I should or some other people have. I don't know. It just, I feel like I've never really seen it done where it's something that's, it's as engaging as people make it out to be.
Yeah.
And I don't really feel that with this, but it is a great film.
Yeah. I definitely enjoyed it. I think this is a really good movie. But again, it just didn't capture me as much as I wanted. But no, it has some really great performances. Kudos to all of the actors involved, especially the lead two, who really carry this film.
Absolutely.
Again, like they are literally on screen the entire time, more or less.
And you kind of feel their agony or you know, pain that they go through along the way on this journey. It's a very convincing performance. Mm-hmm. It feels very authentic and real. And yeah, they we gotta give an acknowledgement to those two actors. Basically, the film is carried by George McKay, who plays Corporal Will Schofield, and Dean Charles Chapman, who plays Corporal Tom Blake.
Yeah,
it's Schofield and Blake just the entire way through. It's just their story. And Chapman's character Blake, he has a brother that he's going to meet on the other side.
That's how they kind of wrangle them into the story, is like, oh, you know, you gotta go save your brother, he's in that battalion, go do this mission for us, stop this battle from happening.
And like, to a credit to this film, that's another thing too, it gives it a literal like personal end game in it, which is really nice to see in a movie like this. I feel like you don't really get that as well.
Where it's sort of similar to like a Saving Private Ryan right? You know,
whereas but like in a film like Dunkirk, there was just nothing like that. It's just soldiers,
very impersonal, right?
Just going about a battle. Battle happens.
Yeah,
and granted, this film is kind of that way too. It's, you know, you it's presented to you, you kind of know what to expect, it happens, and then it ends. But at least it does have touches like that, which is nice.
I will say I really loved the one take, or like the idea of this movie, that it's all shot in one take, or you know, in quotes. You can definitely tell when they you know, do cuts, or mask it, but it is really exceptional.
It's really nice. I like how they kind of, how the trailer, it sort of makes it not, like, it gives you any indication that it would be done like this, because, like, you have those scenes where you get, I believe it's Colin Firth's character, where he's talking to them, but they're actually just in a dark room, but in the trailer it kind of looks like it's at night. It sort of seems like when the lead up to this movie, or it's hearing that about that, it's like, how is this in one take? And sure enough, it's achieved so well. Yeah. It feels like you were following them around, you're walking with them as you go through this. And when it does, you know, it cuts when it needs to, which is really cool. And even that is done in a clever way.
Yeah.
Basically the only way that there is kind of a cut or a break in the action is if one of them is knocked out, essentially. Yeah. And it's really cool. Yeah. You're it does feel like you're living it, which mm-hmm. is really awesome.
Yeah. I don't know. Did you have any more you really wanted to say about it before we kind of delve deeper into it in spoilers?
It's definitely a movie where once you say the plot, that's kind of all you can really say about it. There's not really...
There's a couple specific moments I want to point to that we can't really talk to without spoiling anything.
So I think we should probably go into that. We've talked about it for 10 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's a good war movie. Maybe that's not for us, mm-hmm. you know?
But it's definitely it's an achievement. It's good.
Yeah.
It's a very good film.
It's a cinematic feat, for sure, just in terms of the production. It's really exceptional.
If I were to rate it, I'd say I'd probably give it like a 7.5 out of 10.
Yeah, I was thinking like a 7 out of 10.
Mm-hmm. Like very, very good. It obviously deserves a lot of recognition in a cinematography sense, but for a film experience, it's just kind of not what I look for.
Yeah.
But still really great. I definitely encourage people to see it.
Mm-hmm.
I do kind of feel like it's more of a streamable watch than a go to theaters to see it watch.
I wonder how this movie, I assume it probably was released in IMAX, if I had to guess. I bet it would probably look really phenomenal
on a
big IMAX screen like that. But yeah, I could definitely see this being like a, just, you know, throw it on, rent it. You know, it doesn't necessarily need that big screen, but it is a nice looking film.
Absolutely.
I do also, before we get into spoilers, I do want to say, leading back to when we were talking about screenplay, I really don't get how this is up for best original screenplay.
I don't think
there's enough in this movie that's like really... there's not much dialogue, and even when there is, it's, you know, your basic fare of war generals telling, you know, commanding someone else to do something. Like, it gets personal, and, you know, you feel for these characters, and they definitely have a real relationship, and you feel for them. But honestly, I kind of don't understand the screenplay nomination.
Yeah.
It kind of doesn't make any sense, but...
I 100% agree with that.
Yeah. Let's get into spoilers. There's definitely one spot I want to talk about, so... We're gonna get into spoilers here, so if you have not seen the movie and you're interested, go see it, come back, and we're gonna talk about how one of the main characters, Blake, literally dies like halfway through the movie.
Yeah.
And it was actually a really surprising moment. It was really well handled. That was one of the highlights of the film for me, I think.
It's a very big turning point for the movie, and it serves a very strong purpose, because mm-hmm. it's Blake, he is a crucial part of the story, and since he's going to find his brother,
right.
once they get to the destination they need to get to.
And he's the one who, like, drags his friend along, like, the corporal or whoever, like, tells him, the general tells him, you know, bring along someone with you, and early on in the movie, Schofield, he's kind of like, why did you have to pick me? Like, why bring me? And mm-hmm. they have like this conversation about that. And it was kind of from the get-go, I figured that Blake wasn't going to make it.
Yeah.
But I definitely didn't think he was going to die halfway through the movie.
Right. And then just halfway through, it becomes Schofield's story, which is very interesting. It's a very crucial point in the movie, and I think mm-hmm. definitely it was a moment that was needed at the time that it happens to make it such a enthralling experience and like really suck you into it even more.
And I think that moment really makes you connect to these characters more. They're just good boys, you know?
Yeah.
Like, the scene in particular, if you've seen the trailer, you've probably seen this moment where the British soldiers end up, the planes end up shooting down a German plane, and it crashes into this barn that our two main characters are kind of taking a break at the moment, and they save this German pilot from the burning wreckage, and they pull him out, and Blake is kind of treating him, and he's, you know, the Schofield's actually like, you know, we should put him out of his misery, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe he, even behind that, he's just like, you know, let's kill this German, he's the bad guy. But Blake's like, no, we have to get him water. And then, you know, we follow Schofield over to the well, and we turn back to see Blake get stabbed. And it's like this moment where, it's like such like heartbreak.
It's really
and
sad.
It you know, again, it's showing the horrors of war and the,
especially when, you know, Blake was genuinely trying to save this person's life, and then he ends up dying because of it.
It's really powerful. A really touching moment, and the two of them in that scene are phenomenal together, and it really, you know, it pulled at the heartstrings. It didn't make me cry or nothing, but it was definitely a moment where, like, damn, this movie's actually got, like, you never would have gotten that from something like Dunkirk.
No.
But man, it's just so well handled here. It was a great moment.
Absolutely.
Definitely one of the highlights of this movie for me.
Definitely. And yeah, for me personally, as I said a couple minutes ago, it made me care even more about this story and really get me connected in it, because it's just interesting to see how Schofield can, you know, pull through with his mission and keep going, now being the lone man.
Right, and up to that point, he's still kind of jaded. He doesn't really want, you know, he doesn't want to be involved, you know. Even right before that scene, they're still kind of bickering back and forth, like, why did you have to take me? And after that moment when he sees his friend die, and, you know, he realizes he has to be the lone person to set forth on this mission and save these other British soldiers, it's a really good turning point for that character. It makes a really strong arc for him, especially. Yeah, it's a really good arc for that character, and he really pulled through to really save this movie, I think.
Absolutely. One kind of funny facet of this movie that I wanted to talk about was the extremely minimal performances by and screen time that were given by the quote-unquote
biggest actors.
The big names for this movie, the people that, you know, you see him in the trailer and you think, oh, can't wait to see Benedict Cumberbatch's performance in this. Should talk about that. So we got Colin Firth, Mark Strong, and Benedict Cumberbatch, three very well-known, well-regarded actors who are in this film, but probably get like
each of them must. I think Colin Firth maybe makes a minute. I think
like
Benedict,
Mark Strong at the most.
Mark Strong
probably
definitely makes like 2 minutes. Because Mark Strong is the one time where the character kind of goes away and then comes back at the end.
Yeah.
Because, like, you know, they're in that truck and then he comes back to, you know, give, you know, tell him his goodbyes or whatever. So you get a little bit more of Mark Strong for maybe 2 minutes, but Benedict Cumberbatch and Colin Firth are maybe in it for 30 seconds to a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like, how much did they get paid for this? You know, it's kind of crazy. And
I had to check because I couldn't remember the nominees for Best Actor after seeing this. I just was immediately thinking to myself after we saw this, like, I really hope none of them got nominated, because that would have been the biggest, like, just rip-off ever.
Right.
And thankfully they didn't, because,
I mean, they're all fine.
They're great,
but,
man.
I mean, they're only in it for a minute.
Benedict Cumberbatch's 30 seconds in this film has very much had me feeling like, wow, Benedict Cumberbatch sure can act. He's great, but yeah, he's in it for all 30 seconds. He's just, you know,
and it's a pivotal moment.
It's a pivotal moment.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
But
it's so funny in the way that this film is marketed.
Yeah.
Having them, I mean, obviously you want to have them in the trailers, but it's so funny and, like, seeing the end result.
I mean, I kind of,
what we got
going into it, having heard that it was, like, a one take, you know, like, this journey, I kind of figured that those characters would be so shorthanded, and because, like, it's not like you're the general's gonna come with them on this mission, you know. Like, I figured Colin Firth would have, like, no part in this movie, although I guess I would have expected more from Benedict Cumberbatch. Like, especially, you go, man, this movie goes 110 minutes without him even being there. Like, it's 90% done before he shows up, and then he's there for a minute.
It's like video games that get, like, a really high-profile actor to show up for, like, a cutscene.
Yeah.
But the two leads are the characters you play.
Definitely. And it is actually kind of similar to, like, playing a video game, I guess, in that sense, you know, where you're following these two, it's like a co-op game where you're following right. these two characters and they're just kind of going from point A to B without too much in the middle, you know, not too much dialogue, anything, and it's just them doing different action moments, you know.
If this was the 1917 Telltale game, I totally would have killed that German
yeah, definitely. Soldier.
It would have been like, Blake will remember this.
But Blake will also survive. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah, I guess it would have been Schofield, but we'll remember.
Oh,
it.
Sure, so sure, sure.
Shot.
Yeah. yeah. Other than that, I don't know if there's really too much. Again, I really loved that moment halfway through when he gets knocked out. And he comes back, and it's that nighttime.
Oh, yeah.
That was a really special moment. Like, it looked amazing, the fires in the background and how everything was lit. It was all, like, foggy and smoky.
I really love the scene where he comes across that young mother who is in hiding.
Yeah.
I love how there's actually a purpose to the scene where Schofield just comes across a bucket of milk. There's like a cow on the place where the German soldier had landed his plane. It's a farm, and he ended up, you know, just taking milk. He was out of water, needed some kind of, you know, some type of drink. But yeah, I love that scene. I think that's a
great I thought that was a cool way to bring that milk back, you know, in a special way.
And just also like showcase like how good that these men are, just like what good people they are,
and again showing the horrors of war. This entire thing, like that, the scene near the beginning where they're traveling through no man's land and all of the deceased, all of the really decrepit, you know, rotting bodies that are in these trenches, and like craters, bomb craters. It's really, it's like horrific. It's almost like a horror movie in some ways. That stuff was really phenomenal. There was another moment I was gonna speak to, but now I've forgotten it, unfortunately. I thought it was a good movie.
It's a good film.
Yeah.
I don't think it's 10 nominations good, it's good.
I just remembered what I was thinking of, and I don't think you actually saw it. You kind of missed the like first minute, or like first 30 seconds. But like you didn't miss much. But in the end,
so everybody knows, I was in the bathroom. I was like so assured, like, oh, when I come back, this will be like
two trailers. We walked into the theater. It was a 7 o'clock showing, and we got there at like 7:05.
Yeah,
we like walked into the theater at 7:05, and it was immediately like the movie already.
Yeah, there was still a trailer playing.
Dan literally walked out to go to the bathroom, and as soon as he walked out, I looked up, and it said 1917 on the screen, and I was like, wait, am I seeing a trailer for 1917 while I'm about to see it? And I was like, oh shit, it's the movie.
Yeah.
Because most of the times, we went to a different theater this time, but most times we go to the theaters, it's like 20 minutes of trailer, 25 minutes of trailer sometimes. Least.
And then like maybe two commercials also.
I totally understand why you would have went at that time. But what you missed out on was at the beginning, Schofield is kind of sat up against a tree napping or sleeping. And when Blake gets the order, and he picks him up from the tree to come with him. And at the end of the film, Schofield again ends up at the tree. He sits down at the tree and kind of looks at his the mementos of the pictures of his family. And I thought that was a really nice, you know, circle. How he begins at this tree, and all he wanted to do was sleep, and now he's gone through all of this shit. And now he can finally rest at the end. Not die, rest, but like, you know. I thought that was nice, that whole circular.
I wish I could have seen that.
yeah, you kind of missed out on that little bit there. Too bad you...
Stupid bladder.
Good movie overall.
Absolutely.
Again, like Dan said, maybe not worth the 10 nominations it got, but totally good movie.
Yep, absolutely. Definitely check it out if you have any curiosity about seeing it. I do think this is a film that people that aren't myself are going to like way more.
Yeah.
Such as with like a film like Dunkirk. But
yeah, I think we were definitely on the minority for Dunkirk.
Yeah.
Not
every movie can or should be The Parasite or, you know.
Yeah.
Uncut Gems, so that's fine.
Definitely. I'm glad this wasn't Uncut Gems. It's kind of crazy. It's actually really crazy thinking about like how 1917 didn't have me as anxious as a movie about like some random
gambling, essentially.
It's kind of funny, but 1917 overall good movie, not superb as I wanted it to be, but totally good.
Absolutely.
That's gonna wrap it up here for our 1917 review. We will be right back with a closer.
Closing it out.
Yeah.
Welcome back, everybody, to episode 22 of Infinite Canvas Ultra. So, if you think that you avoided video game talk in this week's episode, you are wrong, because our Q&A segment this week is a list that I got after we recorded our year-end retrospective. And, hey, I'm always down for more lists, so it's down to hear what your favorite whatevers of 2019 are. And this late list that I got was from Christopher, and it's top 5 Switch titles, says in parentheses, excluding ports, of 2019. So
exclusive only to your Switch. All right.
So top 5, at number 5, it's Sayonara Wild Hearts.
Okay,
That game is awesome. I've played a little bit of that.
Oh, have you? Yeah. I've actually wanted to play that.
It's really amazing.
Yeah.
I definitely need to download that soon.
It's basically, from what I know, it's like a pop record by way of, like, fast-paced action video game.
That's exactly what it is.
Like, it's literally supposed to be just, like, an album that they made a video game around.
And it's definitely a thing where I would love to own that record if there's a, because the songs in it are incredible.
I wonder, have you ever looked it up? Is there a release for that? I bet there will be at some point.
I would imagine. I've never checked it out.
There's a company called I Am 8-Bit that does a lot of like indie game vinyl pressings.
Nice.
So I wouldn't be surprised if something like that will have a release like that. Well, the IM8-Bit actually has a physical PS4 copy of the game.
Oh, that's awesome.
But I wonder if they'll have a vinyl at some point. Oh, they do. 2LP vinyl.
That's awesome.
You can get from there, so.
You have to get that game first and then get that. Because, I think I've played a good, like, 20 minutes of it. Because, I mean, it's just you pick a different level. You basically just kind of go through. It's like very, like, you know, rhythm based, like obstacle based. It's really fun. That's a great pick. It's good to see that on this list. Number 4 is Luigi's Mansion 3.
Of course, I'm kind of surprised that's that low. I'm excited to see what else is here. I loved Luigi's Mansion 3.
Yeah, I'm excited to play it. I haven't gotten around to playing it yet, but I'm very excited.
Yeah, you'll really enjoy that game. I'm sure it's a very fun experience.
Number 3 is Untitled Goose Game.
Of course,
super great. I think maybe one of the most viral and like publicized games of the year.
They announced recently that they've sold over 1 million copies of that, which is
awesome.
Fucking, that's wild to me. You know, this little random game about a goose. Like, it's not even, I don't know, it's not even that much of an, like, it's fun, but it's not like a very engaging game where you like want to sit down and play it for hours on end. You know,
it's
just a little like tech demo almost, but it's a good game.
I love that game,
and it's totally deserved. I'm glad that it's getting as much respect and praise and sales as it's getting.
I agree. Number 2, this is one that I have played from this list that I feel like I'd probably rank. I think I maybe had more of a fun experience with Sayonara Wild Hearts than this, actually.
Think I know it.
Legend of Zelda Link's Awakening.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Good game, but I don't know. I think it's fine. That I just don't know if that's something that would, like, I feel like I probably would end up liking Luigi's Mansion 3 like way more.
Yeah.
But it's good to see it on there. Good choice. And then at number 1, and this is a game that's been kind of everywhere in terms of year end lists. Well, if you have any predictions, what do you think it is?
Fire Emblem.
That's number 1.
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
Fire Emblem Three Houses, which that's another game that I've played a little bit of. I just don't think that's my cup of tea.
Not your style. Yeah.
It's very hard for me to get into RPG games, but goddamn, does that game look beautiful. Like, the cutscenes in that look like it's just ripped from a really good anime.
I haven't seen too much of that game, but yeah, for me, it's also kind of, you know, similar feelings where I do enjoy turn-based like strategy games like that, but I think Fire Emblem is out of my wheelhouse. I was always more of an Advanced Wars kid.
Sure.
If you remember those games from GBA.
Yeah.
Whereas Fire Emblem was kind of too heady for me, too much, I think. Mm-hmm. And I definitely think with this, with Three Houses, it's supposed to be even more grand and
it is. Yeah, just from the little bits of it I've played, it's like,
I bet it's also a really long game.
It's pretty fucking advanced, especially for someone like myself that just doesn't really play those games.
Yeah.
This is kind of like, that's like way more than I'd want to chew off.
Yeah, especially.
But I wish I liked it. Like, I wish I had more of an appreciation for it, because I get it. Like, I get why it's resonating with so many people and winding up in a lot of top tens of 2019, but yeah, I wish I could get it, but I'm not.
With games like that, those strategy games like that, it really gets hard to, because like you, I don't play a lot of those games, so I'm not as in tune with like the strategy behind some stuff and like how to actually do my moves and take turns and like going off of like playing XCOM 2 and you know, if you get into these battles and like missions and some of your characters, and I assume Fire Emblem's the same way, where like if your characters die, they're dead, like for good. And if you've like built up these characters, you know, and have them die forever, it's like really like this punishing moment, and that's just like a little too much for me, I think.
Yeah.
I assume there's ways in Fire Emblem to turn that off and make it easier on yourself, but that again, like, it also kind of takes away the spirit, I think. But so it's kind of like that double-edged sword, and I wish I had more of an appreciation for those.
Me too.
But
it's a great list. I have an appreciation for that list. It's
I do too.
Really cool to get a Switch specific, you know, video game list. So that's really awesome.
It's again reminding me that at some point I do need to finally buy and play Sayonara Wild Hearts. I think I saw that on sale recently. Switch. So
I keep forgetting to get a lot of indie or slash like digital games. Like, I need to up my library of that, because there's just so much good stuff.
So much.
That's definitely a representative of that. That game's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, great list. Thanks for writing into us. Gonna close out with some shout outs this week, as we always do.
Yeah. I'm gonna shout out a bunch of old movies I watched this past week. I watched Seven Samurai, which was excellent. I watched a couple Studio Ghibli movies only yesterday, and The Tale of Princess Kaguya, which were both phenomenal. Only yesterday really resonated with me. That was a really touching story. Very slice of life anime. Very different for Ghibli, like that studio where, you know, those movies are very fantastical typically. That movie was, could have been a you know, a live action film,
right?
But it definitely felt great watching that as an anime, and it had some really great moments. But Princess Kaguya, that's a phenomenal looking movie, man. That art style is so, it's really great. I don't know if you've seen anything of that.
I need to watch that.
That movie has like a very different art style than your typical Studio Ghibli, your typical anime, where it's like, I don't even know what it is. It's like watercolors, and it like looks very painted, but also like some of the characters look like they were like drawn with chalk.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's this very weird melding of like art styles, I think, and it just comes off as like really phenomenal looking movie. I think it's actually the most expensive Japanese film ever made.
Really?
I assume so much. Yeah. It's like, and it looks like they animated every scene. Like, it's so many frames of animation. You can definitely tell it a lot of work went into it. It's a really cool movie.
That's awesome.
Some really great movies.
I'm going to shout out a new movie came out in 2019. One that I didn't get around to seeing in the actual respective year. It sadly wouldn't have cracked my top 10, but it sure is an honorable mention. Dolomite Is My Name, starring Eddie Murphy.
Yeah.
Great little film. I just was laughing my ass off in a lot of bits, and just overall just such a positive, just lovely watch. Like, I really like, I love that movie a lot. I think it's super great.
I liked that movie a lot too, but I didn't find myself laughing too much.
Oh, there are bits in there that I think are absolutely hilarious. Yeah. Like, it's super good. Just a lot of it actually came primarily just from Wesley Snipes' performance in that film. Just
he's great.
His mannerisms, like when they're filming the fight scene and he's just making faces and more just is like isn't really taking the cues, like his like punches are delayed and it looks like shit, but I'm blanking on the actor / director that he played, but God, it's just so funny. It's just a film where you could obviously tell everybody on board is just having a great time and are just having so much fun, and it's not in a way that's careless at all. It's just...
Yeah, they definitely have so much respect for all of the people that these characters are based on.
Exactly. It's just, it's a way where, it's done in a way where it's just, it permeates just how much, like, love is being put into that film. Yeah. It's great to see a movie like that, where you could just feel the love coming from it, the love for the source material, the story behind the source material, and the person that made it happen, that made it... arguably one of the biggest, like, you know, kind of cult classic films of all time, Dolomite. I actually put on... I rewatched Dolomite.
Had you seen it? You'd seen it before?
Oh, yeah. Nice. I love Dolomite. My first exposure to Dolomite was, like, back when I first saw Black Dynamite for the first time, like, years and years ago. And then, like, you know, knowing how much that borrowed from that, it's like... Yeah, so it was great rewatching that after seeing Dolomite Is My Name. And Dolomite Is My Name is just, you know, if you haven't seen it, very much in the same wheelhouse as Ed Wood or The Disaster Artist. This film about a filmmaker who is way more off the cuff than your average filmmaker and is quite a character. But I would say that Riri Moore, like, just the way it presents him in this movie... It presents him as way more, like, humble and down-to-earth than, like, your Tommy Wiseaus or your Ed Woods. And I found that very infectious about it, too. He just seemed like just such a genuine, just good-natured guy. And
for me, it was a very feel-good movie. It was, fascinating story. And seeing, like, the background of the making of that film and Rudy Ray Moore's life and everything, it really resonated with me a lot. I thought it was an exceptional movie.
Absolutely. So I'm definitely give a shout out to that.
Yeah. I don't think I really have any more shout outs, really.
I think my last shout out is going to be to Heat, because it is sure cold here in Chicago.
I thought you were talking about the movie.
Why not? Heat. We shout that out too.
Hell yeah. But, it was a good movie.
Actual Heat, because it is like, it feels like zero below out here in Chicago.
It sucks, man. So. It sucks.
If you two are experiencing this, or if it's cold wherever you are, get your blankets, get your sweaters, get warm.
Yeah.
And
stay warm out there.
Took a hot ass shower before I came here, and that is the best feeling ever.
I guess that'll do it for us here with episode 22 of Infinite Canvas Ultra.
Absolutely. Till next time. Till next week. We'll talk to you guys later.
Yeah. See you then.
This week's episode of Infinite Canvas Ultra is sponsored by Midwest Action. For more information on their releases and events sponsored by Midwest Action, you can head to MidwestAXN.com or search MidwestAXN at Bandcamp. Midwest Action. Listen local.